as we say, into their life structure and their life experience. I think sometimes we talk about heredity in this way. We say that we got our love of music from our mother. We talk about this as though we knew this, as though this was something that we would talk about the way we would talk about the rain. It is now raining. This you can see, this you can observe. But to say that you got your love of music from your mother is an inference, is an hypothesis. It implies a great deal to be said in terms of the mechanics whereby you would get something from your mother of this sort. The mechanics of heredity are to a large degree talked about on this level in terms of what might be. And most of us would be unable to talk about that in any sustained fashion. So when we do use the word heredity, as though we knew what we were talking about, we're probably, to a large degree, identifying these levels of abstracting. That is, we're talking about them as though they were the same, as though there was no difference between these levels that is important. I think that very often when we talk the language of the psychologist, or anyway some psychologists, the psychoanalysts, we talk about egos and ids as though we were talking about something real, something we knew for sure, something we might observe at any moment. We are identifying these levels of abstracting. Nobody's ever seen an id or an ego, and we're not going to see one. They are words which don't refer to anything that is observable. They refer to constructs. They are something which we make up to account for what we see people doing. I think most of us, if you are like I was, we can't remember very well the way we used to be, and I don't pretend to be able to be accurate in talking about what I was like as a student, but we were talking about hooking these up so you could turn them out. Now they've got it hooked up all or none, don't they? So I guess you can do that. If I do remember rightly at all, I certainly wasn't aware as an undergraduate or even as a graduate, I think, to any very great degree of the role of imagination in explanation in science or in what we would call knowledge. I suspect that I assumed that knowledge was not imaginative. Right. I think I remember accurately that it was a very difficult sort of idea to grasp, the idea that we represent here that the bulk of, or the greater part of, what we mean by theory or explanation is imaginative. We explain what we do know, what we do see, what we do observe, by imagining what else there might be to account for it. And, of course, if you want to find the most conspicuous and bizarre examples of the identification of this level with these, you would find this in the psychopathic hospital in the person who has delusions, who is sure, so sure that it is almost hopeless to talk with him about it, that he has glass in his intestines, or that there are people around the hospital who are plotting to kill him, and these to him are not possibilities. They are not what might be. They are not beables. They are realities. And he governs himself from moment to moment accordingly. In this, as in nearly all other examples that I know of that would be relevant, the kind of example that would be extremely pathological is not in any essential way different from the more ordinary example, the kind which you and I have, which you and I represent, no doubt, to a much greater degree than we like to think. Some of ours may be almost as extreme as those that are found in mental hospitals, but they are accepted by our society. They're socially acceptable kinds of identifications of this level with these. They're socially acceptable ways to talk as though you knew something when you don't really. All that you can say in a legitimate way is that it might be so, or that it might be useful to imagine. And you've got, haven't you, to the part in the text in which I tell about the example which was used by Albert Einstein to explain what we do when we make a theory. And in case you read it fast, too fast, and didn't ponder it, I'd like to go over it with you, because I think it is tremendously important, and it's the kind of thing that I would hope you'd remember the rest of your life. He says that a man trying to develop a theory about anything that we would call natural phenomenon, to explain anything, is much in the position of a man who is trying to understand a closed watch. He can't open the case. He can hear the ticking. He can see the hands moving around. He can make very exact measurements of these movements and of the tickings. And he says, if the man is sufficiently ingenious, he may be able to make a picture. To make a picture in his own head. That's the point. In his own head. Of the mechanism in the watch case. That might be in the watch case. That might be in the watch case. To account for the ticking. And for the movement of the hand. But then he adds that it would make no sense for anyone to ask whether the picture in his own head of what there might be in the watch case makes no sense to ask whether the picture might be true or not, because you can't open the watch case. Question to ask whether it is true. If by meaningfulness you mean that you will be able to look and see someday. I think when I was your age, the age of most of you, I took for granted that one would always be able to find out eventually whether a statement is true. That's not so. It makes no sense to ask whether the picture is true. You can't open the watch case. All you can ask about it is it a useful picture? Does it enable you to predict how the hands will move in the next few moments or days, perhaps? Is it a picture which makes sense to you in the ways in which the words make sense in your culture? Does it have heuristic value? H-E-U-R-I-S-T-I-C. Heuristic value. That is, is it a picture which tends to stimulate you to make more pictures? H-E-U-R-I-S-T-I-S. Heuristic. I think it's a very wonderful word to know in order to talk about our explanations, our theories, our points of view. This is one of the ways in which we evaluate a theory or an idea. Does it tend to make us have more ideas? Or does it tend to stop thinking? So the more heuristic a theory is, better it is, so long as you assume that it is better to improve on it or to go on trying to theorize rather than to stop as though all the thinking were done. This basic disorder of abstracting, which consists of the identification of levels, the failure to differentiate levels, can also be seen in the form of the person who acts as though these levels were the same. The level of the naked eye, or simple sensing, and that which we call lensing. This is the kind of identification of levels which you see in the ad. You've heard the ad, the fellow in the beer ad, who's from Milwaukee, and he ought to know.
See, if you have seen it, then you know.
The person who returns from a month in Europe and tells you all about how things are over there. This is the person who identifies these two levels. The seeing is believing sort of behavior. The person who believes in it because he's seen it done, and so forth. It is so much of the sensitivity that you develop to the sort of thing we're talking about, the failure to differentiate levels of abstracting, the what might be called in a general sense lack of an active awareness of abstracting, is so often to be observed in ways that are a little hard to describe. If you were going to try to describe the language behavior of a person who was a non-lenser, in the sense in which I'm using the term here, he talks as though all the data are in, it doesn't matter. It isn't important to try to look further, to be more thorough. And why this is ordinary, this is what you do when you go to one doctor instead of two. And almost all of us do, of course. We're encouraged to have one doctor. I have one doctor, don't you? We're encouraged to go to one dentist and to be loyal to your dentist. It's a good idea, we think. And it probably is for most things. It's the sort of thing we do almost always when we get advice. We tend not to check it. Some of the ways in which one acts as though he were aware of the difference in these levels of abstracting are rather ordinary too. It is to be seen in the behavior, for example, of persons who read the consumer's research bulletins before they buy a refrigerator. It can be as simple as that. You investigate. You go to, you look at a large variety of what you're going to buy. You look at six cars. I don't want to say too little about the person who always buys Buick. There may be something else to be said about him besides what I'm about to say. But he is acting as though this is all he needs to know. He doesn't have to investigate. But there may be other things to be said about him. Yes?
Looking at one joint or looking at another automobile that is not accepting somebody else's investigation.
Well, I didn't say not to to accept somebody else's investigation.
Well, let's say that
read consumers' reports. If you do that, you have to accept somebody else's investigation.
Let us say that the person does not read consumer reports on the automobile, but he simply goes to see a plant, he goes to see a Dodge, he goes to see a Buick. Now, are you saying that the difference here between simple sensing and lensing?
No. can do an awful lot. You can be very thorough on either level. And I'm awfully glad you raised the question. I might have made, I might have left a misimpression, or made it easy for you to misinterpret what I mean. I was emphasizing the fact of being thorough, investigating further. And it isn't enough to say that. You can do that on either level. You can investigate further. The important thing is to secure information that you can't get by the naked eye, by looking at the upholstery and so forth. And this will usually be in the form of some kind of an engineer's report. And you are not likely to make much of an examination yourself of this kind unless you are able to do it. I couldn't do it very well. I would have to make use of various laboratory reports, and they are available in most cases if they're important to you. Whether they are to be regarded as important to you is perhaps a complex question. It depends on how much money you have to spend and how much you have to save and other things too.
Even the necessary product, and the farther you get away from the viable level, the most dynamic level, is it necessarily related that you're going to become more static, or potentially more static the farther you get away? Or is it a function of something else?
Potentially more static, potentially less informed. I mean, to get away from, stay away from, less informed. If you are going to compare two foods and decide which you are going to eat, now this, you see, you won't usually go into a lot of trouble at a given moment in a given restaurant, and you can. The time. But while you're in college, you could take a course in foods so that you would know more than you can find out by looking and sniffing at two foods. You would find out something about what is known by persons who use various kinds of lensing procedures or analytical procedures to evaluate foods and who test them out in various biochemical ways and so forth. And you will end up then doing a better job of simply deciding what to eat. And the less you inform yourself kind of information that can be obtained on this level, the less informed you are, of course.
These are really more general questions, not
Yes. Yes. Thank you. These are not hard and fast levels. This is sort of a relative affair we're talking about. These are not numbered like the degree marks on fever thermometer, but you can develop a good deal of sensitivity to when you are being more vague and more detailed. Now, there's a general failure to differentiate all of these levels that are the verbal levels from all of these levels that are the nonverbal levels. A kind of a way of acting as though it were enough to be told something it were enough to have read something, to have heard of it, as though what you are able to say is sufficient. So there is no great difference between the map and the territory. I'd like to see if I can help you to develop an awareness of the fact, that is perhaps, I mean more of an awareness of the fact that these levels are what we would call silent, nonverbal, unspeakable, as for instance Wittgenstein, the philosopher, says, what can be shown cannot be said. What can be shown cannot be said. Which is another way to say the word, no matter what level it is on, is not the object, no matter what level it is on. The map, no matter how detailed or how vague, how general, is not the territory, no matter how detailed it may be known. Now, is this important? If it is, it's important from moment to moment, not on a final exam, not just in school, not just in some fields, but not in others. If it is important at all, I would think it is always important. And how is it important? Well, let's take a homely example. You think you're falling in love with somebody. That's pretty important. I don't want to reduce love to a formula, but it's all right to raise some questions, I think. You say that to this other person that you know, you feel as though you were one with him. You know how he feels. Now, how do you know how someone else feels? What do you mean by this? Can you tell someone this? If you can know how someone else feels, the point is, you will have to know it on nonverbal levels, if you're going to know it thoroughly. Now let's take a very, very simple thing that will help us to understand this. You have to watch me. I want you to pinch your finger. Real hard. Go ahead. Now, you'll think this is silly, but don't think so. This is very profound. Go ahead. I know it's probably hard for graduate students to do this, but try. Go ahead. Pinch your finger. Keep pinching it now. Pay attention to what you're doing. Now, who would like to tell us all just how that feels? So we'll know how your finger feels. Anybody want to try? Then who can tell me just how my finger feels? Anybody want to try? Pinch yours now, that's all I'm doing. I'm pinching mine, you're pinching yours. Now you know how your finger feels. Now tell me how my finger feels. Does this make the point? It's enough? See, now then, can you live with that? nobody ever to know how you feel. Can you bear to be that much alone? That's how alone you are. You may not think so. You may kid yourself. Someone else understands, or is going to someday. Someday they'll understand. I think this is one of the most important kinds of information we have to come by and assimilate and learn to live with if ever we are going to mature, to become a mature individual. To do this, you have to learn to live as alone as you are, as alone as you have to be, with no more understanding from other people than they are capable of experiencing. And this is more than they are able to tell you about, because the feeling is not what you say the feeling is. The word is not the feeling. You can never tell me the feeling. You can talk about it, and of course you will always talk by using metaphor, and you will use a substitute for the feeling in order to talk about it, the substitute being words and intonations and so forth. And so far as I am able to interpret them, as we say, so far, I suppose that means, in large part, as your words and intonations are associated with feelings in you that are like the feelings in me that are associated with like words and intonations, then I can say I understand what you're trying to say. But, of course, there is a great attenuation or loss in the telling. And so I never quite know. And this I have to learn to live with, yes? Well, if there is no way to determine whether it's true or not, if there's no way to determine that, what then does it mean to ask whether it is true or not? That's a good example.
If you ask me how my finger feels, I am just as correct or just as meaningful in saying that it feels the same way as your finger does to you as you are in saying that it doesn't.
Well, I'm not saying anything. That's just the point. I'm trying to emphasize this is a silent level of abstraction. This is not words. And any words you may use are not the feeling. May be the feeling, the words may be the feeling. Let's get one thing very clear. Those words, are they the feeling?
No,
that's the main point that I want to be sure we're all very, very clear on. Nothing you say is going to express the feeling itself. Now, if we grant this, then we have another problem. And it can be worded various ways, I suppose. But if you ask, is what you say about the feeling I have in my finger true? If you're going to make that assertion, or if you're going to raise the question whether it is or not, you're obligated to give instructions to anyone who wants to check up and find out whether it is true. Now, what are these instructions? How will you tell anybody to find out whether the statement is true? I see. Yeah, I think now you have said something that I think is very important. You and I will have more understanding, more to understanding common, the more things we do in common. If you want to know what it's like to have a hearing loss of 35 decibels, it would help to poke some cotton in your ears. Leave it there for a day. And then you begin to have some idea of the difference that makes. What don't you hear? What do you hear? What are the mistakes you make? What are the misunderstandings that arise, etc., as a result of it? You still, however, don't know what it is like to have a hearing loss. And so long as you are aware of that, so long as you're aware of the limitations of your understanding, it pays to get more understanding by trying to have a hearing loss, by pinching the finger, by having experience.
But even if
that's right. That's right. That's
right.
This is one of the very important facts in the case of people like me, or who go into speech pathology with a stutter, and I have to be very careful not to assume that everybody else is like me. You see, everyone has a problem. The heart specialist who has a bad heart must be very careful not to assume that every person who has a bad heart like his bad heart.
But someone else could have a bad heart.
Yes, he might. It would be almost like it. And this would be helpful, wouldn't it, for him to have had one like it. It could be. What are you trying to say primarily? What do you mean by the same, and how would you find out that it is that they are the same?
I don't think you could find out, but I think that...
Now, shall we talk about that a little while? Because this was somewhat relevant to what you were saying, and it is a very fundamental point. When I was a student, as far as I can remember, I assumed that there were two kinds of statements. There were those that were true and those that were false. And I had already gained much more age than you have now before I found out that there's another kind which is terribly important, and that is the meaningless. And neither true nor false. Now, there are various kinds of meaningless statements. One is has to do with feelings. If you make statements about what a feeling is exactly like, how will you prove that what you have said is true or false? But that doesn't keep you from saying, I think I feel the way you do. Huh?
Wouldn't it be all right to say everything perhaps I might feel like you do? Wouldn't it be possible you might be right?
Might be right. Wouldn't it be possible you might be right? But how would you find out whether you're right? What? With the risk. Well, that's another matter. That has nothing to do with what we're talking about. Oh, I would be likely to think it'd be worth the risk myself. If that's what, go ahead and fall in love. That's all right. Don't hesitate. I'd say it's worth the risk. But that has nothing to do with what we're talking about. We're talking about whether you can determine whether the statement that Joe is the statement Joe loves you is true. Now, if you make it that way, then you can define love, so you can tell. You can define it behaviorally. You can say he brings me flowers. That's how I know. Well, then that's what you know. He brings you flowers. But that's all you know, unless there is something else, and then what's that? Now, so you get done listing them. He brings me flowers, he takes me to dinner, he goes to movies with me, he kisses me goodnight, etc., etc., etc. And of course, it's a long list. Is it enough? These are interesting questions, aren't they? What all does he have to do before you are sure? And suppose all he does is to say, I love you. Now then, how can you tell? He's not here. He's 1,000 miles away. He writes it. How will you determine whether this statement is true? Now, I think, you see, for practical purposes, this turns out to be a meaningless statement in the sense that you can't determine whether it is true or false. It may be meaningful to you in other ways. And so it's pretty important, I think, to know what you mean by meaning. Well, our time's up for today.